Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming. My name is Myron Sauter. I'm from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And this is my wife, Sarah. We attend the River Brethren Church there. And it's my first time down here at CLP. So I'm glad to be invited here and glad to share with you. I enjoyed the talk we just came from about the focusing on Jesus Christ. It reminded me that the hymns that we're looking at are on the same theme. Jesus Christ is the one whom everybody's talking about, everyone's writing about, and obviously everybody's singing about. He made a reference to that verse in Colossians where it says about singing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. The verse maybe affirms our workshop here in a way. Maybe it doesn't affirm the poets the same way. It doesn't say write poetry there, and it doesn't say I need you to compose essays or things like that, but it says I need you to sing. We're going to do singing here, and I brought a document camera, and I'm going to project hymns onto the screen here. So the front seats will be the best here, since we don't have a real big screen, so feel free to move further front if you can't see well enough in the back. Rediscovering hymns from the past. The titles of my workshops were assigned to me, so I pondered a little bit where I could go with that. The topic rediscovering hymns from the past made me think of how hymns change over the years. That was one of the takeaways that I noticed years ago when I put together this handbook for spiritual hymns, which is a study of the hymns in the River Brethren Church hymnal. This is a copy of the church hymnal that we use, a small text-only book. So I started looking up where the hymns came from, and I wrote a note in here somewhere in the introduction. One of the things that struck me was how few hymns that we sing. I was fascinated by how few of the hymns appear in our hymn book in the same form that the author intended. So the hymns wait to be rediscovered. We may have discovered them, but there's rediscovering waiting for the student of hymns. Hymns of different generations, we're going to look at specifically at including hymn tunes from different categories of history, and hymns that appear differently in different books. That's topic number one. Text edits. A text gets edited while it's composed, but you know, it gets edited a good bit after it's composed as well, even after it's published. I went on to say, most of these changes, I noticed in my particular research, most of these changes were perpetrated by the editors or compilers of hymn books. I picked that verb. It's not a real neutral verb. They were perpetrated by the editors or compilers of hymn books. And our current hymn book is no exception to this trend. So, we're starting with a hymn that appears in our hymn book. I'm going to use this hymnal that you're familiar with probably a good bit, the 1969 hymnal that may deserve the adjective red if you like. It's a historical hymn book in many ways. The editors went back and looked at how hymns used to be. So in many cases this will have a earlier version of the text than other books. So, text edit number one comes from this familiar hymn, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing.
we have the big vocabulary word here in verse 2 that we do Bible studies on. But I'm looking particularly in the end of verse 3. So, time is limited and the hymn is familiar. We'll just sing verse 3 as it appears in this hymnal, which may be, or maybe as you know it, or maybe different from how you know it.
Oh, to grace, how great a debtor daily I'm constrained to be. Let that grace now, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above.
Is there anybody who's sure you've met this phrasing before? Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Okay, that's just over half of us probably. That was new to me because I learned the hymn in our River Brethren hymn book where it's 219. Here's how our book has it. From thee would I never wander, never leave the God I love. Here's my heart, but take and seal it. I think we're probably in the territory of a theological discussion here, why that would have been changed. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Or maybe you could, even on the grounds of, I like this for its humility. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. And I know there's room for more discussion than we have time for here, but personally, I wouldn't, if I were publishing, I wouldn't change it to what we have here. Someone else did. I think it's, this is the Christian Hymnary's version. Exactly when or where it changed, I'm not sure, but this is how the River Brethren sing it, and it's a fine sentiment. But I'm not against singing this one. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Any comments about why it would have changed from this? Yes.
I'm not sure, but I think, if I understand it right, John D. said that John Abraham made the change. If you look at hymns of the church, John D. made it different.
Thank you, Mark. Okay.
The third option.
Which I don't think helps. Here's a third stop on the first example of number one. So John D. Martin changed it further. Would I say that if he were here? Well, it's true. I don't think it helps. Here's the latest and latest phrasing of this text. Sore temptation, Lord, I feel it. Passion strains to quench my love. Here's my heart, O take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. One of the things I'm asking here is what part of speech is strains? Is it a verb? But could there... I feel it. Passion strains. Somehow I'm also hearing it as a noun with adjective. These are passion strains that I'm feeling. So there's an example of how book editors do it. A few strokes of a pen, it gets out there for thousands and thousands and thousands of people to sing for years.
Did the author of those words actually stray from the faith later on in his life or have a bad time at one point?
I did hear that it's ironic that Robert Robinson would say prone to wander because he was prone to wander. Yes, so there's a fragment of a hymn story I've heard that he struggled with his faith later in his life. Let's go to another familiar hymn. You know, Hark the Herald Angels Sing. I don't think I'm even going to turn to it right there. We're going to look specifically at the first word, first phrase. Charles Wesley wrote this hymn, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, Glory to the Newborn King. That's not how he wrote it, though. I was fascinated to learn some time ago at what he had originally. Here is an image of the first printing of Hark the Herald Angels Sing, hymn for Christmas Day. And he's using here this word welkin. You see how it goes, hark how all the welkin rings, glory to the King of Kings. We have a vocabulary change and a little other phrasing changes as well. He has it in verses of four lines instead of eight, as we're familiar with. And he has eight of them here. And is using the little bit of spelling changes as well. Just interesting to see that. This is the thing that makes hymnologists smile when they see how hymns wait to be rediscovered. What did Charles Wesley mean? What did he picture? This is how it was published, and this is not what you and I see exactly. It is approximately, but it's not exactly. Some of these verses are dropped, some of these were changed, and this hymn, the particular article that includes these images that I'm looking at, has detail after detail about who changed the text and when. But apparently the word welkin was used in that time period. The welkin is a word that refers to the dome of the skies. The angels are up there in the sky singing, and the whole sky is ringing with their song. We don't have a word. We should have this word. We're a little bit impoverished. We don't know what a welkin is. We don't have one word that refers to it. But he's even using capital letters here. Does that mean he knew German? Capital letters for your nouns, but he's not consistent either, is he? Almost. Okay, there was a small stop number two on text edit. And finally, let's look at another one of Charles Wesley's, because I have a comment that John Julian made about it. Again, in the Mennonite hymnal, Jesus, lover of my soul. Let me to thy bosom fly. While the nearer waters rule, while the tempest still is high. I wonder if the hymn book that you use is exactly like this or approximately like this. The River Brother book changes it a little bit. Here's our version, and here's my red ink corrections and my comment from Julian. Here's how I learned it. Jesus, lover of my soul, the S wasn't original. Let me to the bosom fly, comma, while the billows near me roll, while the tempest still is nigh. That's how I learned it. But the red ink on the right here, while the nearer waters roll, is Wesley's version. And while the tempest still is high, the River Brothers sing about a tempest that's nigh instead of one that's high. Here's John Julian's comment. I brought along, this is one of two volumes of a dictionary published in the late 19th century and updated in 1907. Dictionary of Hymnology, covering the origin and history of Christian hymns and hymn writers of all ages and nations. All ages and nations. But when it's over 100 years old, it's no longer of all ages, is it? It's an old book, but still one of the most helpful around for studying old hymns. So in here, with over 1,000 pages of small print about hymns and where they came from, came this comment. There are more than 20 different readings of the first four lines. And John Julian, who knew of, I don't suppose of every hymn that existed, but of many, thousands of them, said, we know of no stanza or portion of a stanza which has undergone so many alterations. Charles's brother John was among the first to edit Charles's hymns, even while telling other people not to do so. And apparently everybody else can improve on Wesley as well, though we can't write, we can't produce him, but we can cavil with what he did write. So text editors are alive today. Our next segment of rediscovering hymns is looking specifically at the tunes. I'm going to write a timeline of tune genres. For this list, I'm using this hymnology textbook. If you want to read about hymns in a way that's oriented toward the classroom and where everything's organized for consumption of students at a college level, you can consider this book, Sing with Understanding, revised and expanded, though growing older and older. But very helpful in its topic. I'm looking at the chapter that talks about the hymn and music. We're going to look at the development of and rediscover how tunes developed in seven categories. Roughly on a timeline. Roughly chronological. The first category is plain song. I'm going to put 1500 here, 2000 here. Where does plain song belong? Well, plain song is also known as Gregorian chant, attributed to Gregory I, who was Pope from 590 to 604. This is the oldest kind of church song, if we can call anything, if we can know anything that specific about what happened in the Middle Ages. And it still exists, but I'll sort of drop that line there. The squiggle represents, it's off the map, and most of what happened in the Middle Ages is not documented. Also known as plain chant or Gregorian chant. The earliest church musicians didn't even know how to write down their music, but they developed early systems of notation different than ours that I don't even know how to read. But we're going to sample a tune that fits in the same family, even though it's really not as old as the earliest plain song would be. This book calls the tune O Come, O Come Emmanuel. It calls it a 15th century trope melody. So this may have come from the 1400s. Let's sing it as an example of some of the earliest, rediscovering some of the earliest tunes that we know that Christians sang. Like I said, it would have appeared in a far different version of the version than this, but we'll do what we can.
Oh, come, oh, come,
to talk about harmony, more specifically that harmony is a modern, four-part harmony like that is a modern notion. You see the attribution for the, underneath the 15th century there, it says the hymnal noted 1854. So there's a Victorian conception of how to sing an ancient melody. Plain song. One out of our seven categories for tunes. Number two is the Lutheran chorale. So here we are. Luther was born in the 1490s. So I'm going to take this one up. I'm going to take it into the 1600s. And I'm going to talk about two distinct eras of the Lutheran chorale using maybe the most familiar one, A Mighty Fortress. A Mighty Fortress appears in this historical hymn book more than once. The Lutheran chorale would have been printed originally in a version that we would call a rhythmic chorale. You see, this hymnal doesn't put any time signature there, but it is a tune by Luther. I'm writing the word rhythmic here because if we can sing it like it's written, we're going to say that it sounds syncopated, but that's how the Lutheran chorales appeared in their earlier form. Later, they were changed in the Pietist era, and I read an article in the Hymn in which a Lutheran writer bemoaned this change, said it's such a tragedy of how the Pietists just ran into the Lutheran churches, and they changed the theology, and as a direct cause and effect change of their theology, they changed the meter and the harmonization of their tunes. Pietism. Okay. In the Pietist era, I was going to write here, a word describing a different kind of rhythm where it's in 4-4 time, where the beats are more like each other. I'm writing the word homorhythmic here to refer to that. The homorhythmic era of the Lutheran chorale would have been in the era of Pietism in the 1600s and later. Zinzendorf was born in 1700. He was a Pietist. He was educated at the Pietist schools. So for historical purposes, we should sing the rhythmic one first. Now, in this hymnal, they went so far as to put it in its original language, which, let's try. It's German. We'll be brave. We're doing a whole bunch of new things at once here because the rhythm is hard. Especially down here, we don't have any half notes, which I sort of hear the B as half notes here. This looks like my writing. I tried to simplify the rhythm to figure out what's happening, and there's some ties happening here, so it sounds like syncopation. But we'll give what we can, and then we'll go to the familiar one and see if we prefer to be plagius.
Unfelsenberg is untergott, and good ever amen. Er gift und frei aus allen Wart, die uns es hat betroffen.
A few seconds here. Zoom in as far as I can.
Can you brighten it too?
Again?
Could you make it brighter?
Let me try. Push the alt image button, see if anything happens. Thank you for that suggestion. Ready?
There are find me dexters, yes, mind cross fatum's villains.
Sorry. Yeah, that is the first word.
Sein Rassen rust zu nicht, auf erdisch bis ein
That's more difficult, granted. That is more difficult than the other version, which we may skip since time flies, if you're familiar with that. But there's the two main schools of the Lutheran chorale. There's more where that comes from. Depends which hymn book you buy, whether you're going to have only the Plagius forms or a wider variety of forms. If you want more Lutheran chorales than you've seen in your favorite books, buy a Lutheran hymnal. They're still more predominant in those books. Number three, the Calvinian psalm tune. John Calvin was born a little later than Luther, so I'm going to put this just about here. You know, off the top of your head, what year he was born. And his tradition obviously went into the Puritans in England, so we'll extend it. John Calvin was first in Geneva, but his influence spread to England and to Scotland, where they, in both of those countries, are notable for having psalters that featured these psalm tunes and didn't use a great variety of tunes. The Lutheran tunes didn't make it into the Reformed hymn books very much. And there was even a German version of Calvin's Psalter that was used by the German Reformed. These hymn tunes are greatly different in style. And again, since the books we use are very eclectic and use tunes from throughout church history, there will be some familiar ones here. But I decided to focus in on a version that is maybe slightly less familiar. We're looking at this maybe best known of all hymn tunes, I'm not sure, at least I suppose the best known of all of Calvin's psalm tunes. Come from a book, 83 Psalms, when they were putting the Psalter together in Geneva, they didn't get it all done at once. They published it in several parts first. They published it with melody only, but they had composers who just could not keep their hands off of these unison tunes. They couldn't keep from harmonizing them. So just a few years later, Claude Gaudimel harmonized the whole Psalter like he wanted it to sound. Let's sing this version that has the melody and the tenor. This is number 3 in this hymnal. John Calvin wanted everybody to sing unison for, well, everything he did had theological reasons. So it's for unity. It's for unity and focus on Jesus Christ. And we're with him on focus on Jesus Christ. I guess we say that we're accustomed enough to the parts that we don't stop worshiping when we start singing in parts. So let's try it. If you want to sing the melody, you'll find it right here. And so on. I was going to point out the rhythm as well. This is the original rhythm. First, it's not all quarter notes. You don't have a time signature here. Time signatures weren't as standard back at this time period. And you'll see more half notes here than you expect. So just get ready for that.
Mi sodom, O people that are
that rhythm. You might call this rhythmic chorale. Maybe we should divide the Calvin psalm tunes in the same two categories, because for some reason we've made them homorhythmic as well. And is it easier? Just start singing and plug away with all quarter notes. But this has an added interest that we don't know about, and that probably gets into the question of harmony versus melody as well. Because if you're singing melody only, rhythm is where your interest comes from. There's no harmonic interest. So your composers will give you more interesting melodies rhythmically. When you add the harmony, then, you don't miss the rhythmic interest as much if you don't have it. I think we should sing this rhythm. Maybe not this harmonization, which has its complications, but here, there's another one up here at number 2 that, again, has a long half notes there. It doesn't have as much, doesn't have the syncopation in the harmony. So that's the Calvinian psalm tune. And there's many, many more, really hundreds and hundreds of psalters published in England and Scotland. And the first book published in America, the Bay Psalm book. It was a psalm book for Calvinistic singers in churches. Number 4, Victorian part song tune. Victorian. Ooh, looks like we're leaping ahead. Obviously these, I guess it's obvious, I'm not continuing them the whole way on. We're singing them today after the year 2000, so they're still somewhat alive, but they're moment of creation is over. Same with the Victorian part song tune. That places us firmly in the 1800s. Queen Victoria, longest reigning British monarch until recently, right? The editor here is calling it a part song tune to draw attention to the harmony. The song in question, the kind of tune in question, is characterized by rich and often chromatic harmonies, and then sometimes single note, repeated note melodies. such as
Jesus, the very thought of thee.
And sometimes mildly repeated rhythms. But the thing that stands out to me is the chromaticism in the harmonies that these Victorian songwriters were happy to use. Let's sing St. Agnes. In the classical music of the era, the tonal system was breaking down. Everything was breaking down in Victorian England. The belief in God was breaking down. Tennyson was strong, but many of the poets, Matthew Arnold and others, were not so sure about the realities that had been firmly fixed. The church was on the rocks, and when Victoria died, the early 1900s was, at least in the 1920s, we know what the reputation of the 20s in America was, and Europe is usually a little ahead. So, back to music. The classical music of this era was stretching the limits of the tonal music system and using harmonies in new ways. So the hymn tune composers were as well. It's not extreme in this example here, but almost any tune of this era, you'll find some chromatics. And this one, not real wild or hard to reach, but still chromaticism. And here's another one with the tenors. A little bit harder, we have a re against a raised do against a mi. So that's intended for harmonic color right there. Let's sing this one one time through, see if you can get the harmony as well as possible. Enjoy this chord again. Can we check whether we have somebody on each part and stop on the word there, when one there wish. Who's tackling the bass? Thank you, tenor. Good, I'll try to help there. And soprano, alto, good. What a starting place. Soprano, alto, tenor, bass, 1, 2, 3.
When one there wishes.
Good. Let's do that again. Hold it, and then hear the resolution. Bass is going straight across. We have a re, fa here. What would happen if there had been a la in there? Why didn't the alto go up? Because of parallel fifth, right? It almost sounds like a mistake. In fact, I'm not sure 100% if we were on. So let's try it again and hear the resolution.
Let's do this pitch. Do, sorry, I changed the pitch. Do, mi, so, mi, do, so, re.
Resolution, easy as possible, basically going across and everybody else stepwise. So it's doable for a congregation. Victorian part song tune, that's what they wanted to hear. It's rich in chromatic harmonies. And again, there's an example of the repeated note melodies. Three mi's there, three so's there.
Number five, folk tune. How to graph a folk tune. Folk tunes are timeless. So let's do it. I'll do the same thing. They're from time immemorial, from all times and places. And are they still going? Yes. I suppose the ones in our hymnals are now in print and are a little bit solidified and pushed into fixed forms. But people still sing from their hearts. And what percent of the population can read musical notation anyhow? Most of the people in your congregation are musically illiterate. Or some degree of literacy, hopefully. But we don't put near as much effort into music literacy or notation literacy in our schools as we do into other literacy. We even say literacy meaning letters of the alphabet, right? And we have to put music in front of music literacy. And there's good reasons for that, I'm sure. But we could read notes better if we would work harder at it. Folk songs are songs of the people, and hymns are as well. Hymns, most of the people on Sundays sing from memory, even if they have a book in front of them, or sing mostly from memory. So hymns are folk songs of the people. So this category has five different parts, according to this editor, and there are many more. I'm going to start off with the carol. Carols are hard to define. I put it back here near the left because in one definition of carol has it as a medieval tune. Sometimes, but not always, associated with the celebration of Christmas. Carols in their medieval origin were associated with dance. Some are still characterized by dance-like rhythms, such as Good Christian Men Rejoice, which is not in this formal hymnal. The First Noel is an old tune. What Child Is This? Green Sleeves, an old tune about love. So, if folk-like spirit is accepted as a main determinant of carols, then Joy to the World or Silent Night are probably fit as carols, and maybe that's why we use that now to mean Christmas hymn. Those are familiar, so let's go on to English folk tune. English folk tune. Let me put this up here in just... Okay. This is 5.1. English folk tune. I'm going up here near 1900 because we're looking at an example from Ralph Vaughan Williams. Williams was a British composer who took walks around the countryside. Some people pick up leaves, some pick acorns, some pick mushrooms. Vaughan Williams picked up folk tunes on his walks around the countryside. He sat down with old men and old ladies and wrote down what they sang. Then he took it back and put it in written form. And published it, harmonized it, and we have it in shape notes. Here's one with the date 1906 from the English hymnal that Williams was a music editor of. King's Fold. This one is giving the melody a composer, Lucy Broadwood, but it's the other book listed it as a folk tune category. If you don't know King's Fold, maybe because you don't use British hymnals enough. Enjoy this.
I heard the voice of Jesus say, come unto me.
For whom was that a rediscovering? It wasn't the first time you've known Kingsfold before. Okay, so we're rediscovering hymns and tunes. English folk tune. And there's more where that comes from. So you might want to buy the 1906 book English Hymnal, and you'll have plenty of Vaughan Williams in your diet after that. 5.3, Welsh tunes. Welsh tunes. Well, again, where should we put these? I guess I'll put it somewhere here in the Victorian era. If they're folk tunes, they're timeless, may have been sung for who knows how long, but some of them do have names and dates attached. Welsh tunes. Welsh tunes consist of a pattern of four lines with one or more of them repeated. Here's our favorite. Immortal, invisible, God only wise. Obviously, the first line gets repeated, and then it goes on to something new. Let's go right through this, and then we'll sing one that's not quite as familiar.
Immortal, invisible, God only wise, enlightened, accessible, hid from our eyes, most blessed, most glorious, the Ancient of Days, almighty, victorious, thy grace.
Welsh Hymn Melody. I suppose this is a name of a hymnal? Gaelic? Maybe one of you can do better at me with what that means. 1865. Here's the tune name. Maybe somebody can do better at me than at this. Double L. Langlofen? Something like that. Double F. I guess they know how to spell.
The double L is an odd sound. It, I'll refrain from trying to.
Okay. Oh, it's fun to hear Welsh people talk. We came to Lancaster County. I met someone on the city bus, a Welsh person. He said, "Oh, I'm so glad to see the Welsh names around here. We have a little borough of Lampeter." South of Lancaster, he said, "Yes, Lampeter." He said, "I see you have Lampeter here. So glad to see that name." Oh, okay, so we have Lampeter. Let's try this.
Oh, young and fearless prophet of ancient Galilee, thy life is still a summons to serve humanity. To
settlement in Southern York County. They say they have an annual singing there. The people that I met in Lancaster came over from Wales to go to that singing in York County. So you can go and visit there. Another anecdote I can't resist telling. The Welsh hymn singing, I put it in this period because that's when Welsh revivals were. And hymn singing is still alive and well in Wales, even though they're more secularized. Somebody that visited, a Welsh person that visited our church, I mentioned this to them, and they said, oh, yes, we still sing, oh, guide me, O thou great Jehovah, written in Welsh. We sing it. Oh, the whole, everybody in the country loves it. In fact, it's our song in the stadium before a rugby match. That's what everybody belts out. Believers, unbelievers, drunk, not drunk. Everybody belts out that song before every rugby game. Guide me, O thou great Jehovah. American tunes. I'm going to put this in the same time period because of the shape note tune books that appeared around then. And we're going to incorporate two things here. I have a copy of the Sacred Harp. That's a tune book that appeared in 1844. And I have a song in here that has some interesting story about it that takes us to the third point. Depending how much time we have, we'll have some trivia about rediscovering hymns. So I'll give you a little bit of the story, and if there's time, I'll finish the story. Here's an American tune. Here called The Morning Trumpet. We're in the Sacred Harp, page 85. Attributed to B.F. White, 1844. This is a hymn called O When Shall I See Jesus, written by John Leland. John Leland. When I was researching this for our hymnal, I found a story about it recorded by George Pullen Jackson in his book Down East Spirituals. And John Leland was a hymn writer, a preacher in Cheshire, Massachusetts. He was a vocal supporter of Thomas Jefferson. And he and his congregation were so happy when Jefferson was elected that they decided we should take him a present. We should take him a cheese. So they got a cheese together, and does it say how big it was? It was big enough to be worthwhile to put on a sleigh and drive 3 weeks to Washington, D.C. from Massachusetts to take Jefferson the cheese. That's what sort of man wrote this tune. This hymn, O when shall I see Jesus and reign with him above? We're going to quiz you here on whether you can follow the four shapes of the Sacred Harp. We come out to here. I'm sorry it's small because it's an oblong tune book. Come out to these repeat marks and then come back to the beginning to sing the second line of text. Out to here, back to the second line of text. Melody appears here in the tenor. So you can choose your part. And it should be sung fast. Maybe second time through. Second verse will be fast. Okay, the words are up here now. Oh, when shall I see Jesus and reign with him above? And shall hear the trumpet sound in that morning. And from the flowing fountain drink everlasting love. And shall hear the trumpet sound in that morning. Shout, oh glory, for I shall mount above the skies when I hear the trumpet sound in that morning. This represents the American tune type of folk tunes.
The
oh, when shall I see Jesus and reign with him above, and shall hear the trumpet sound in that morning, and from the flowing fountain drink everlasting love, and shall hear the trumpet sound in that morning. Shout, oh glory, for I shall mount above the skies when I hear the trumpet sound in the morning. Shout out glory, for I shall mount above the skies. When I hear the trumpet sound in that morning.
Good job on the backwoods harmony there. 19th century American tunes, shape note, they were harmonized in a style using forbidden harmonies and progressions. Things you're not allowed to do. They're using chords without thirds. They're using parallel fifths, breaking other laws. But they were hillbillies and didn't know or didn't care, and they started a tradition that's still alive today. Let's sing verse 2 a little faster if we can.
When shall I be delivered from this world of sin, and shall hear the trumpet sound in that morning? And with my blessed Jesus drink and his pleasures in, and shall hear the trumpet sound in that morning. Shout, O glory, for I shall mount above the skies when I hear the trumpet sound in that morning. Shout, above the skies, when I hear the trumpet sound in that morning.
Good job. Okay, there we are on a 5 out of 7 styles of tunes, and we're right on schedule because number 7, innovative hymn tunes, is pretty well our talk tomorrow, or this afternoon actually, new hymns. So we'll keep that one. We have time here to look at number 6. Again, we're in the 1800s, and that is, any guesses from the crowd, what's a distinctive type of tune from this time period that we didn't name yet?
Gospel song?
Yes, thank you. Gospel songs. And truth to tell, it's just been an hour or two since you sang 3 of these in a row. What would a song leader pick at the Writers and Artists Conference if you want something to bring, something familiar, to bring everybody together, and something easy and singable? We sang 3 of them, including Fanny Crosby. These are 19th century America, and then in the 20th century, characterized by major key melodies, simple harmonies, the basses can go straight across. And some chromatic harmonies and compound meters. At least 2 of what we sang had 6/8 meters. So, depends which hymn book you're in, they're easier to find. The formal hymn book that I mentioned had to include some gospel songs because people like them, but it put them inside a fence. So they're not under God, Jesus Christ, Holy Spirit. Where are they? They're in a little section at the end. 520. If you want to sing gospel songs, you can go to number 527 and you can get your fill there. To God be the glory. That's not 6/8 time, but it has a chorus. These all have choruses. I was listening to recordings of Eric Routley, a hymnologist, recently. He said that songs with choruses presuppose soloists singing the verses and everybody on the chorus. We don't do it that way, do we? What were they sung like 150 years ago? When Ira D. Sankey sat up front and introduced songs that nobody had ever heard before. He was probably singing by himself on the verse, and then everybody joining in on the chorus, and what did the basses have to complain about? Straight across right there. everybody can learn the chorus good, but the verses have new text every time. So would you sing them if you didn't have it in print? Okay, so am I right that the 250 has arrived? Did we hear a 5-minute bell? Okay, I think it's 250. Is this the end of count? Okay. Yes. So thank you for being here, joining me on our rediscovery of hymns. Go in peace.